Okay, it's great to be back with you for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's featured guest, Rick Rule, the Director, President, and CEO of Sprott U.S. Holdings. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome the chairman of Sprott U.S. Holdings. Rick Rule makes his debut appearance here on GoldSeek.com Radio. Helped found Global Resource Investments in 1994, which was subsequently purchased by Sprott. Welcome, Rick Rule.
A pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Let's begin with the global repatriation fiasco. You know, most gold aficionados know that the Bundesbank requested the return of its 1,500 tons of U.S. gold held in U.S. coffers. However, the U.S. denied all but 300 tons. They only offered 20% to be returned, and they only sent about 5 tons last year, while, the French sent back 37 tons. Paul Craig Roberts has offered a new twist on the story. The reason why the U.S. only promised 20% is that the gold has either been sold on the markets or it's just been leased out. The Fed has illegally sold much of this gold to suppress the precious metals prices. I'd like your thoughts on this.
I do think that this is something that every investor in the world needs to think about, and certainly that every U.S. citizen needs to think about. During the same period that the German public pressured the Bundesbank to repatriate their gold, and during the same period that the repatriation order was entered, while the United States failed to deliver 1,200 tons of gold through official sovereign markets, Chinese government and Chinese citizens were able to contract for 1,120 tons of gold in the private physical market and get it delivered. Now, one needs to ask oneself, either the Chinese are much more efficient at loading gold on planes than the Germans are, or else this speaks to the availability of gold in the physical market and the unavailability of gold on the sovereign market. Given that the Germans are smart enough to hire Chinese if they're less efficient at ordering gold, it tells something about the nature of the difficulties between the two markets. And what could that be? My suspicion is that the gold in sovereign hands has been leased, and released, and leased again, meaning that where there was gold, there are now deposit receipts. Otherwise, why would you fail to repatriate? I know for sure if a bullion dealer held 1,000 ounces of gold for me, and I called them up and said, I'd like my gold back, and they said, we'll give it to you over 7 years, my first action would be to call the police. I suspect that the Germans didn't call the police because there's no police to call.
They did, Rick, call the police, didn't they? But the problem is they called the folks that are holding their gold.
Well, my suspicion is that the German government asked for repatriation because it was politically expedient to do so in Germany. The German government had absolutely no intention of causing any chaos in financial markets. And also, my suspicion is that if the gold has been leased and released and released, that some of the hypothecating parties were probably German banks, like Dresdner Bank and Deutsche Bank. I don't know this to be true, but my suspicion is that what will need to happen over 7 years is that the current holders of the gold, or pardon me, the last parties on the daisy chain, will need to repay gold to bullion banks, who will then need to repatriate gold back into the treasury before it can be delivered to the Germans. And my suspicion is that the 7-year time frame offered up bears a striking relationship to the underlying hypothecation arrangements with regards to that gold. What that really tells people is that there is 1,200 tons minimum of unmet demand in the market, as gold which has already been sold has to be purchased back to be delivered against these contracts, which is a very, very bullish sign. The other thing it tells you is that if this is true, above-ground gold reserves that we think are in sovereign vaults have probably been leased and released, which would suggest that the gold that's available for good delivery, as an example, in the context of futures contracts, is much less available than we believe or we have been led to believe.
Well, I think you've drawn some interesting inferences from the data, and I'd like to drill down a bit further. on this story and the implications. You know, even if the gold exists in Fort Knox, West Point, and New York, but has instead has been leased several times over, I think we need to address just what that could mean. And at the most basic level here, there's really only two options as I see it. Either the U.S. will have to make good on these promises at some point and deliver some of the stockpile, or there will have to be some type of default on some of these contracts. And it would seem as though either scenario is wildly bullish for the precious metals. The cartel that is supposedly behind the suppression would no longer have their ammunition if they send the gold back to the Bundesbank. All they'd have left are paper promises and nothing to base it on. I'd like your thoughts.
Irrespective of one's belief with regards to a cartel, that the structure of the gold market is extremely bullish. As you point out, gold that has been leased and released and leased a third time or a fourth time, if nothing else, simply needs to be repaid. And the structural dynamic that's set up by repayment, and by the way, not repayment once, but repayment two or three or four times, is very, very, very bullish. And the very fact that all of the gold which is deemed to be supplies in central bank vaults, its existence needs to be called into question. Now, my suspicion is that the German government will be extremely, extremely cooperative with the U.S. government. And I think the possibility of default associated with this obligation are very, very low. My suspicion is that structurally this will simply provide an undertone of demand for the gold market. But it goes to a very, very different question. And that question is the disequilibrium between three gold markets. The physical gold market, which has been spectacularly strong, not just strong in China, and not just strong in India, where, by the way, they put in place a 20% excise tax to break demand, but demand was unbroken as a consequence of the wonderful efficiency of Indian smugglers, but also wonderful demand for physical gold in North America, in Europe, and in Japan. You have this tremendous, tremendous, tremendous physical demand that was actually, in fact, driven in some measure by the decline in the gold price from $1,900 to $1,200. And this exists in a real sort of dichotomous relationship with the futures market. Now, the futures market, as you will recall, led the gold price up in 2009, 2010. It was a momentum-driven trade, a carry-driven trade, where gold was, if you will, nothing other than the fodder for another strange set of derivatives. When the momentum came out of that paper-driven market and the disintermediation occurred, in other words, as the leveraged financial longs had to unwind positions against declining momentum and higher interest rates, the futures market led the physical market. In other words, the futures markets came off substantially. The dichotomy came when the bargain hunters in the futures market, in the physical market, pardon me, began to buy more and more and more gold. And it is my supposition that real markets always win out. As we see less and less good delivery gold available on the futures markets, and as the legitimate unwinding in futures markets disappears, my suspicion is that the physical market will lead the futures market higher. Finally, we need to take into account the third actor, that is the official sector. And with regards to the official sector, their real intentions, I think, were very clear in 2000 when the British Treasury, at the absolute bottom of the market, sold their gold holdings. And former friends of gold, as an example, like Alan Greenspan, have said at any reasonable price, the business of a central bank is to lease their gold, to turn an inactive asset into an active asset by attracting income on it. And I suspect that is what we have seen with regards to the United States' inability to repatriate to the Germans gold that was, in fact, the Germans' gold. It is my supposition. I can't prove it. Nobody can prove it. But it is my supposition that with regards to most central banks, the gold that they carry on their balance sheet is gold that has been lent and relent. And what you have is, in effect, a hypothecated instrument, a promise to pay, rather than the gold itself. Gold is supposed to be a medium of exchange that is simultaneously a store of value, not a promise to pay, but payment itself. In fact, when you have loaned that gold in returned for an instrument, you have obviated the value of the gold that's associated with the fact that it is not a promise to pay. It is, in fact, repayment. And you have, in fact, made a fiat currency out of gold. You've made a promise out of something tangible. And I think that's extremely bullish for the gold price.
2014 shaping up to be a revival period, if you will, for the precious metals sector. You say you've seen things this dismal before in 1991 and in the year 2000. After both periods, the markets turned around sharply. I mean, look, we saw a 12-year rally in gold after the 2000 lows. I'd like to give you a chance to tell folks more, please.
The only good thing I can say about getting old is that you've experienced this before. And as they say, well, you know, history doesn't always repeat. It always rhymes. This is analogous to several periods I can describe. One period in terms of the gold price itself that I think it's directly analogous to is the experience I had in the middle of the decade of the 70s when I was just cutting my teeth in resource markets. Your listeners will recall the gold price in that wonderful decade ran from $35 an ounce, albeit price controlled, to $850 an ounce, a bull market of wonderful dimensions. Many people forget that in the middle part of that secular bull market, there was a cyclical rally in late 1975 and early 1976. Gold had run from $35 an ounce to $200 an ounce, and it fell 50% from $200 an ounce to $100 an ounce. Those people who lacked either the courage and conviction or the cash to stay the trade got shaken out in a 50% cyclical decline in a secular bull market, and they missed a move from its $100 bottom to an $850 top 5.5 years later. The point of all this is that the decline in gold that we just saw from a $1,900 top to an $1,100 bottom, a 40% decline, was in fact a cyclical decline in a secular bull market. It did not break the bull market. It's important to note that what we saw was a cyclical decline in a secular bull market that was in fact healthy for the market, if unhealthy for the participants. And it in no way, shape, or form obviated the fact that we are in a precious metals bull market. Going to the other side of your question, with regards to the equities, if we notice that the commodity indexes themselves bottomed in the third quarter of last year, what we certainly saw was that the better resource juniors bifurcated in the fourth quarter of last year. Bifurcation is the process by which the best 20 or 25% of the issuers separate from the junior resource market and head up. We saw a situation where this occurred very dramatically beginning in October of last year. Headed up on weak volumes, which always happens in a bear market, past this prologue here again, the bargain hunters, the courageous, come into the market, begin to buy stocks, and the sellers are exhausted, so you see moves up on low volumes. This occurred precisely as you describe in 1991, 1992, and spectacularly, I recall, in July and August of the year 2000. It's also important for those listeners that you have that are fairly new to the market to understand very simply that bear markets are the authors of bull markets. They're the cause of bull markets. The rallies that you sustain off these wonderful, wonderful, wonderful bottoms and the supply constraints that are put in place as a consequence of these bear markets are why we enjoy bull markets that the markets exhibited in 2009, 2010. That is the exuberant heights of bull markets that cause the bear markets. So bear markets cause bull markets, and bull markets cause bear markets. Hence our slogan at Sprott, in resources you are either a contrarian or a victim. The choice is yours. What's important to note is the aggregate math over a decade. When a market goes over the waterfall, so to speak, people in that sector lose 50% of the value of their portfolios, or in a particularly ugly market like the one we went through, 75% of the value of their portfolios. What's worthy to note is the magnitude of the gain coming out of the decline mirrors the magnitude of the decline, meaning that junior markets coming out of a decline can exhibit 500 or 600 or 1,000% gains. It's instructive for your listeners to know that the aggregate value of the Sprott mutual funds in the period 2000 to 2011 increased from about $200 million at the beginning of the period to in excess of $5 billion at the end of the period. So while you have experienced the pain in the last 3 years, get ready to experience the gain in the next 3 years.
Excellent. Well, we all like those 25-fold moves, and I'd also like your thoughts on the IPO market for the mining shares. As I understand it, you've been heavily involved in this area for years, and you've noted that restrictions facing new offerings and approaching former capitulation points as this lack of faith and capital scarcity collude in the sector, making it, I think, appealing from a contrarian perspective. I'd like your thoughts.
Well, absolutely. Anything, I mean, bear in mind, I'm no fan of regulation in any way, shape, or form. What the regulators do by constraining capital markets, however, is increase the value of existing supply by making it much more difficult to raise capital in these markets. So it's odd that in this context, the regulators actually do me a favor. I think what you point to has two different sources. One is that capital is harder to raise in bear markets because the perception of the future is set by people's experience in the immediate past. And despite the fact that this is precisely the set of circumstances where one should invest, one doesn't invest in bear markets unless somebody has been through several of them. So mercifully for me, many of my younger competitors who might be faster and stronger than I are frozen out of the market, while I, as a consequence of experience, am aggressively participating in the market. The second thing is that every day, in every way, capital markets get more and more constrained, both in the United States and Canada. Of course, in the United States, it's become absurd with Sarbanes-Oxley. But our Canadian cousins are sort of chasing us into the abyss of meaning that the capital markets get more and more regulated every day, meaning that more and more money is stolen by from shareholders by regulators. And while that's unfortunate, it's something that we have to deal with. That very constraint means that existing companies that have already made the money and paid their price face less and less competition from aspiring issuers going forward.
Well, you know, according to one source, your fund recently made a $50 million bullish bet on the precious metals sector that you believe could grow another tenfold to approximately $500 million or half a billion dollars. Please tell folks what led you to this decision and the implications for our listeners today.
Well, I need to say that that wasn't my bet. Mercifully, I work at a place called Sprott. It's called Sprott because it was founded by Eric Sprott, who is still the largest shareholder. Eric Sprott has made a fortune in the last three decades by being a committed directional investor. Like every self-made billionaire I have ever met, they are self-made billionaires because they have the courage of their convictions. And Eric is absolutely convinced, more convinced than me, by the way, that we have reached an inflection point in precious metals and, in fact, reached that inflection point last summer. And Eric believes that the next 12 to 18 months that we see are going to show sharply higher precious metals prices. But Eric is aggressive enough that the leverage inherent in precious metals is not enough for him. And he has actually sold physical precious metals because he wants to redeploy the money in the marginal junior producers or development stage companies whose value escalation in the face of rising gold prices will be perhaps an order of magnitude greater than the value escalation in the metal itself. Eric has specifically said that this particular speculative strategy will result in one of two outcomes. He will either give back or lose half of the money or more that he invested, which he's done before, and as he puts it, won't change his decision as to what to have for breakfast, or it will result in tenfold or 15-fold gains in the 12 or ensuing 18 months on a going-forward basis. And if you think about that juxtaposition of risk to reward, let's assume it was just a binary outcome. On the one hand, you could lose half your money, and on the other hand, you could enjoy a 10 or 15-fold gain. For those of you who could afford that type of binary bet, it's a pretty good bet. If, however, you believe, like Eric, that this is a probability, not a possibility, that the outcome isn't binary, a 50% chance, but rather that the deck is stacked 80-20 in your favor, it becomes an extraordinary bet. Your listeners will have to decide for themselves, first of all, if they can afford that magnitude of loss, if they have the courage and the cash to stay the trade in what will be a very, very, very cyclical environment, and also whether or not they think that the outcome is unlikely, binary, or likely. but certainly for speculators that have the cash and the courage to stay the trade, who believe, as Eric believes, that we are past the inflection point with regards to gold or silver, this is a very, very, very interesting trade, analogous to the trade he made in the year 2000 when he suggested that a uptick in the price of gold, silver, platinum, and palladium was not only inevitable but imminent.
Following the habits and traits of successful people is something that you have clearly made a practice of. And you say there's an interesting juxtaposition between the millionaire and the billionaire. You alluded to that earlier. From what I've read on your work, you say essentially, look, no guts, no risk-taking, no $1 billion. You must have the propensity to go against the herd, to go against the crowd, to make your own decisions, and then have the intestinal fortitude to have the courage of your convictions. Tell folks more, please.
I think that's absolutely critical. I think in the first instance that you have to be disciplined as a person to save and invest more than you consume. In other words, that you have to be willing to invest in your own future. To be a capitalist, to take advantage of the capitalist system, involves having to have some capital. And so you have to save as opposed to consume. The second thing that you have to do is you have to work very hard, study very, very, very hard, so that you have convictions that are based on something other than what you read in something like Time magazine. You have to have better information than your competitors because you studied harder and you worked harder. But if you have done that, if you have done the work to separate yourself from the pack in terms of knowledge and preparation, you have to act on it. Too many very intelligent people who have worked very, very, very hard follow the following investment paradigm. Ready, aim, 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 aim. They never pull a trigger. They never fire. The bad speculator does ready, fire, aim. He doesn't prepare. He pulls the trigger all the time with no preparation. It's ready, aim, fire that works. And when I look at the billionaires who I have had the good fortune to come across in my career, and there's been many of them, what I have noted is that they're very bright people. They're very curious people. Interestingly, they're not consumption-oriented. They're money-oriented, to be sure, but not to spend it, to have it, and to stay in the game. That they think harder, they work harder, they are contrarian, and they absolutely positively act when they suggest that the situation is their favor. If you look at George Soros, a very, very, very famous guy, he went from being a penniless refugee in 1956 to being a billionaire. And he described how he did it very succinctly. He said he found commonly held precepts that were wrong, and he betted against them. He had the cash and he had the courage to stay the trade.
I'd like to keep with your analogy and use George Soros. If you take your ready aim analogy and maybe make a parallel, his reflexivity, what I would say is ready aim fire and then duck, because you'll recall that George Soros is more than ready to proclaim that he makes mistakes all the time in the markets, and he's not afraid to reverse course abruptly. And we saw this, for instance, last year, where he sold out of some losing positions. And I'm sure the next time we see the next SEC report, we'll see that George Soros has loaded the boat on some type of gold, whether it be StreetTrex GLD or some derivative thereof, reversing course and loading up heavily in the precious metals. So I just like the idea of ready, aim, fire, and duck, the style that I think made George Soros a billionaire, along with your concept of having the courage of your convictions. Wonder if you have any parting comments, anything that's on your radar screen that you think our listeners need to be aware of at this time?
Well, several things. Remember once again that this is a cyclical and volatile business. It is my belief that we have passed the bottom and we are into the early stages of a bull market. This bull market will be of longer duration and greater magnitude than most of us dare dream for. But there will be extreme cyclicality. Make sure that you have the courage and make sure that you have the cash to stay the trade. Remember that we're in a rising channel that will have higher highs and higher lows. But the junior stocks individually will be up or down 20 or 25% in the course of a week for no reason whatsoever. If you are prepared to use volatility as a tool, this will be a spectacular market. If you are not, you will be victimized by that very same volatility. Also, while I'm attracted to gold, I'm attracted to silver, and I am particularly attracted to platinum and palladium. What you learn in this market over time is that when you get to ask yourself questions that begin with when, not if, you will do better. It is certain to me, I can't say when, that gold will emerge superior to U.S. treasuries as a store of value. It is also sure to me, at least if passed as prologue, that silver is probably gold's more leveraged cousin. And it's sure to me also that, separate and apart from it being a precious metal, that the platinum group metals, as a consequence of their unique fabrication utility and the fact that on a global basis the cost of production exceeds the price they sell for the product for, with regards to platinum and palladium, the price must go up as a consequence of cost and can go up as a consequence of utility. When something must happen and can happen, I submit to you that it will happen. And asking yourself investment questions that begin with the word when, in other words, will this occur in 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, not if, meaning will this occur, confining yourself to asking yourself questions that begin with the word when is a superior way to invest.
Please tell folks more about the Sprott family of investments and any other contact information you'd like to leave with us today.
Well, first of all, Sprott is a public company, and if you want to invest in our products, you can also invest in us. The symbol is SII on the Toronto Stock Exchange. It's important to note that although we're a financial services business, we have $340 million in working capital and no debt, which makes us different than most other financial services business. We have $10 billion in assets under management and administration, including the Sprott Physical Trust, which trade on the New York Stock Exchange. Assist investors primarily in the United States and Canada. You can get in touch with the U.S. part of Sprott at our website, which is www.sprottglobal, that's SprottGlobal.com, or you can call us at 800-477-7853. Two things that we would particularly ask or invite your listeners and readers to do is that if you email us your securities portfolio, we will give you an absolutely no obligation ranking of every resource stock in your portfolio and send it back to you. Secondly, if you come to our website, www.sprottglobal.com, and click on Sprott's Thoughts and subscribe, you will receive in your inbox 3 times a week an absolutely free blog from Sprott on resource topics. Eric Sprott, Dr. Mark Fauber, John Embry, myself, and the other analysts and portfolio managers give up ideas and paradigm 3 times a week on precious metals and natural resource ideas. I absolutely guarantee that you'll get your money's worth because it's absolutely positively free.
Well, I want to encourage all of our listeners today to send over your portfolios. What a wonderful service and excellent idea. Think of the analysis that you could receive on your individual positions and no obligation whatsoever. We want to thank you for your time today and look forward to your next appearance on GoldSeek.com Radio.
It was certainly a pleasure. I enjoy the quality of the questions.